A troll, an orc, a Balrog of a man. He stood 2 inches shy of 7 feet tall, and he wore his glossy hair drawn back and tied in a curt ponytail. 10 years before, a claymore had blown up in his face during his second tour of Vietnam, and now his countenance was a horror show of scar tissue with runneled flesh. His left eye was gone. There was nothing where it had been but a ravine. He would not have plastic surgery or an artificial eye, because he said when he got to the happy hunting ground beyond, he would be asked to show his battle scars. When he said such things, you did not know whether to believe him or not. You did not know if he was serious or leading you on for reasons of his own. Over the years, Rainbird had been a surprisingly good agent, partially because the last thing on earth he looked like was an agent, mostly because there was an apt, ferociously bright mind behind that mask of flesh. He spoke 4 languages fluently and had an understanding of 3 others. He was taking a sleep course in Russian. When he spoke, his voice was low, musical, and civilized.
"Good afternoon, Cap."
"Is it afternoon?" Cap asked, surprised.
Rainbird smiled, showing a big set of perfectly white teeth. Shark's teeth, Cap thought.
"By 14 minutes, he said. "I picked up a Seiko digital watch on the black market in Venice. It is fascinating, little black numbers that change constantly. A feat of technology. I often think, Cap, that we fought the war in Vietnam not to win, but to perform feats of technology. We fought it in order to create the cheap digital wristwatch, the home ping-pong game that hooks up to one's TV, the pocket calculator. I look at my new wristwatch in the dark of night. It tells me I am closer to my death, second by second. That is good news."
"Sit down, old friend," Cap said.
As always, when he talked to Rainbird, his mouth was dry and he had to restrain his hands, which wanted to twine and knot together on the polished surface of his desk. All of that, and he believed that Rainbird liked him, if Rainbird could be said to like anyone. Rainbird sat down. He was wearing old blue jeans and a faded chambray shirt.
"How was Venice?" Cap asked.
"Sinking," Rainbird said.
"I have a job for you if you want it. It is a small one, but it may lead to an assignment you'll find considerably more interesting."
"Tell me."
"Strictly volunteer," Cap persisted. "You're still on R&R.
"Tell me," Rainbird repeated gently.
And Cap told him. He was with Rainbird for only 15 minutes, but it seemed an hour. When the big Indian left, Cap breathed a long sigh.
"Both Wanless and Rainbird in one morning? That would take the snap out of anyone's day. But the morning was over now, a lot had been accomplished, and who knew what might lie ahead this afternoon?" He buzzed Rachel.
"Yes, Cap. I'll be eating in, darling. Would you get me something from the cafeteria? It doesn't matter what, anything. Thank you, Rachel."
Alone at last. The scrambler phone lay silent on its thick base, filled with microcircuits and memory chips, and God alone knew what else. When it buzzed again, it would probably be Albert or Norville to tell him that it was over in New York, the girl taken, her father dead. That would be good news. Cap closed his eyes again. Thoughts and phrases floated through his mind like large, lazy kites. Mental domination. Their think tank boys said the possibilities were enormous. Imagine someone like McGee close to Castro or the Ayatollah Khomeini. Imagine him getting close enough to that pinko Ted Kennedy to suggest in the low voice of utter conviction that suicide was the best answer. Imagine a man like that sicked on the leaders of the various communist guerrilla groups. It was a shame they had to lose him, but what could be made to happen once could be made to happen again. The little girl, Wanless sang, "The power to someday crack the very planet in 2 like a china plate in a shooting gallery." Ridiculous, of course. Wanless had gone as crazy as the little boy in the D.H. Lawrence story, the one who could pick the winners at the racetrack. Lot 6 had turned into battery acid for Wanless. It had eaten a number of large gaping holes in the man's good sense. She was a little girl, not a doomsday weapon. And they had to hang on to her at least long enough to document what she was and to chart what she could be. That alone would be enough to reactivate the Lot 6 testing program. If she could be persuaded to use her powers for the good of the country, so much the better. So much the better, Cap thought. The scrambler phone suddenly uttered its long, hoarse cry, his pulse suddenly leaping. Cap grabbed it.
The Incident at the Mander's Farm. 1. While Cap discussed her future with Al Steinowitz in Longmont, Charlie McGee was sitting on the edge of the motel bed in Unit 16 of the Slumberland, yawning and stretching. Bright morning sunlight fell aslant through the window, out of a sky that was a deep and blameless autumn blue. Things seemed so much better in the good daylight. She looked at her daddy, who was nothing but a motionless hump under the blankets. A fluff of black hair stuck out, that was all. She smiled. He always did his best. If he was hungry and she was hungry and there was only an apple, he would take one bite and make her eat the rest. When he was awake, he always did his best. But when he was sleeping, he stole all the blankets. She went into the bathroom, shucked off her underpants, and turned on the shower. She used the toilet while the water got warm and then stepped into the shower stall. The hot water hit her and she closed her eyes, smiling. Nothing in the world was any nicer than the first minute or two in a hot shower. "You were bad last night." A frown creased her brow. "No, Daddy said not." "Lit that man's shoes on fire. Bad girl, very bad. Do you like Teddy All Black?" The frown deepened. Unease was now tinctured with fear and shame. The idea of her teddy bear never even fully surfaced. It was an underthought, and as so often happened, her guilt seemed to be summed up in a smell, a burned, charred smell. Smoldering cloth and stuffing. And this smell summoned hazy pictures of her mother and father leaning over her, and they were big people, giants, and they were scared. They were angry. Their voices were big and crackling, like boulders jumping and thudding down a mountainside in a movie. "Bad girl, very bad. You mustn't, Charlie. Never, never, never." How old had she been then? 3? 2? How far back could a person remember? She had asked Daddy that once, and Daddy said he didn't know. He said he remembered getting a bee sting, and his mother had told him that happened when he was only 15 months old. This was her earliest memory. The giant faces leaning over her, the big voices like boulders rolling downhill, and a smell like a burned waffle. That smell had been her hair. She had lit her own hair on fire and had burned nearly all of it off. It was after that that Daddy mentioned help, and Mommy got all funny, first laughing, then crying, then laughing again so high and strange that Daddy had slapped her face. She remembered that because it was the only time that she knew of that her daddy had done something like that to her mommy. "Maybe we ought to think about getting help for her," Daddy had said. They were in the bathroom, and her head was wet because Daddy had put her in the shower. Oh, yes, her mommy had said, "Let's go see Dr. Wanless. He'll give us plenty of help, just like he did before." Then the laughing, the crying, more laughter, and the slap. "You were so bad last night." "No," she murmured in the drumming shower. "Daddy said not. Daddy said it could have been his face."
"You were very bad last night."
But they had needed the change from the telephones. Daddy had said so.
"Very bad."
And then she began to think about Mommy again. About the time when she had been 5 going on 6. She didn't like to think about this, but the memory was here now, and she couldn't put it aside. It had happened just before the bad men had come and hurt Mommy.
"Killed her, you mean? They killed her."
"Yes, all right, before they killed her and took Charlie away." Daddy had taken her on his lap for story time, only he hadn't had the usual storybooks about Pooh and Tigger and Mr. Toad and Willy Wonka's great glass elevator. Instead, he had a number of thick books with no pictures. She had wrinkled her nose in distaste and asked for Pooh instead. "No, Charlie," he had said, "I want to read you some other stories, and I need you to listen. You're old enough now, I think, and your mother thinks so, too. The stories may scare you a little bit, but they're important. They're true stories." She remembered the names of the books Daddy had read the stories from, because the stories had scared her. There was a book called Low by a man named Charles Fort, a book called Stranger Than Science by a man named Frank Edwards, a book called Night's Truth, and there had been another book called Pyrokinesis, a casebook, but Mommy would not let Daddy read anything from that one. "Later," Mommy had said, "when she's much older, Andy," and then that book had gone away. Charlie had been glad. The stories were scary, all right. One was about a man who had burned to death in a park. One was about a lady who had burned up in the living room of her trailer home, and nothing in the whole room had been burned but the lady and a little bit of the chair she had been sitting in while she watched TV. Parts of it had been too complicated for her to understand, but she remembered one thing, a policeman saying, "We have no explanation for this fatality. There was nothing left of the victim but teeth and a few charred pieces of bone. It would have taken a blowtorch to do that to a person, and nothing around her was even charred. We can't explain why the whole place didn't go up like a rocket." The third story had been about a big boy, he was 11 or 12, who had burned up while he was at the beach. His daddy had put him in the water, burning himself badly in the process, but the boy had still gone on burning until he was all burned up. And a story about a teenage girl who had burned up while explaining all her sins to the priest in the confession room. Charlie knew all about the Catholic confession room because her friend Deanie had told her. Deanie said, "You had to tell the priest all the bad stuff you had done all week long." Deanie didn't go yet because she hadn't had First Holy Communion, but her brother Carl did. Carl was in the fourth grade, and he had to tell everything, even the time he sneaked into his mother's room and took some of her birthday chocolates. Because if you didn't tell the priest, you couldn't be washed in the blood of Christ, and you would go to the hot place. The point of all these stories had not been lost on Charlie. She had been so frightened after the one about the girl in the confession room that she burst into tears. "Am I going to burn myself up?" she wept, "like when I was little and caught my hair on fire? Am I going to burn to pieces?" And Daddy and Mommy had looked upset. Mommy was pale and kept chewing at her lips, but Daddy had put an arm around her and said, "No, honey, not if you always remember to be careful and not think about that thing. That thing you do sometimes when you're upset and scared." "What is it?" Charlie had cried. "What is it? Tell me what it is. I don't even know. I'll never do it. I promise." Mommy had said, "As far as we can tell, honey, it's called pyrokinesis. It means being able to light fires sometimes just by thinking about fires. It usually happens when people are upset." Some people apparently have that power all their lives and never even know it, and some people, well, the power gets hold of them for a minute and they... She couldn't finish. "They burn themselves up," Daddy had said. "Like when you were little and you caught your hair on fire, yes? But you can get control of that, Charlie. You have to. And God knows it isn't your fault." His eyes and Mommy's had met for a moment when he said that, and something had seemed to pass between them. Hugging her around the shoulders, he had said, "Sometimes you can't help it. I know, it's an accident, like when you were smaller and you forgot to go to the bathroom because you were playing and you wet your pants. We used to call that having an accident, do you remember? I never do that anymore." "No, of course you don't. And in a little while, you'll have control of this other thing in just the same way. But for now, Charlie, you've got to promise us that you'll never, never, never get upset that way if you can help it. In that way that makes you start fires. And if you do, if you can't help it, push it away from yourself. At a wastebasket or an ashtray. Try to get outside. Try to push it at water if there's any around. But never at a person," Mommy had said. And her face was still and pale and grave. "That would be very dangerous, Charlie. That would be a very bad girl, because you could..." She struggled, forced the words up and out. "You could kill a person." And then Charlie had wept hysterically, tears of terror and remorse, because both of Mommy's hands were bandaged, and she knew why Daddy had read her all the scary stories. Because the day before, when Mommy told her she couldn't go over to Deanie's house because she hadn't picked up her room, Charlie had got very angry. And suddenly the fire thing had been there, popping out of nowhere, as it always did, like some evil jack-in-the-box, nodding and grinning. And she had been so angry she had shoved it out of herself and at her Mommy, and then Mommy's hands had been on fire. And it hadn't been too bad. Could have been worse, could have been her face, because the sink had been full of soapy water for the dishes. It hadn't been too bad, but it had been very bad, and she had promised them both that she would never, never, never... The warm water drummed on her face, her chest, her shoulders, encasing her in a warm envelope, a cocoon, easing away memories and care. Daddy had told her it was all right, and if Daddy said a thing was so, it was. He was the smartest man in the world. Her mind turned from the past to the present, and she thought about the men who were chasing them. They were from the government, Daddy said, but not a good part of the government. They worked for a part of the government called the shop. The men chased them and chased them. Everywhere they went, after a little while, those shopmen showed up.
I wonder how they'd like it if I set them on fire, a part of her asked coolly, and she squeezed her eyes shut in guilty horror. It was nasty to think that way. It was bad.
Charlie reached out, grasped the hot shower faucet, and shut it off with a sudden hard twist of her wrist. For the next 2 minutes she stood shivering and clutching her slight body under the ice-cold, needling spray, wanting to get out, not allowing herself to. When you had bad thoughts, you had to pay for them. Deanie had told her so.
Two. Andy woke up a little at a time, vaguely aware of the drumming sound of the shower. At first it had been part of a dream. He was on Tashmore Pond with his grandfather, and he was 8 years old again, trying to get a squirming nightcrawler onto his hook without sticking the hook into his thumb. The dream had been incredibly vivid. He could see the splintery wicker creel in the bow of the boat. He could see the red tire patches on Grandfather McGee's old green boots. He could see his own old and wrinkled first baseman's mitt, and looking at it made him remember that he had Little League practice tomorrow at Roosevelt Field. But this was tonight. The last light and the drawing dark balanced perfectly on the cusp of twilight. The pond so still that you could see the small clouds of midges and no-see-ems skimming over its surface, which was the color of chrome. Heat lightning flashed intermittently. Or maybe it was real lightning because it was raining. The first drops darkened the wood of Grandfather's dory, weather-beaten white in penny-sized drops. Then you could hear it on the lake, a low and mysterious hissing sound like the sound of a shower. Charlie must be in the shower. He opened his eyes and looked at an unfamiliar beamed ceiling. Where are we? It fell back into place a piece at a time, but there was an instant of frightened freefall that came of having been in too many places over the last year, of having too many close shaves and being under too much pressure. He thought longingly of his dream and wished he could be back in it with Grandfather McGee, who had been dead for 20 years now. Hastings Glen. He was in Hastings Glen. They were in Hastings Glen. He wondered about his head. It hurt, but not like last night when that bearded guy had let them off. The pain was down to a steady low throb. If this one followed previous history, the throb would be just a faint ache by this evening and entirely gone by tomorrow. The shower was turned off. He sat up in bed and looked at his watch. It was 11:15. Charlie? She came back into the bedroom, rubbing herself vigorously with a towel. Good morning, Daddy.
Good morning. How are you?
Hungry, she said. She went over to the chair where she had put her clothes and picked up the green blouse, sniffed it, grimaced. I need to change my clothes.
You'll have to make do with those for a while, babe. We'll get you something later on today.
I hope we don't have to wait that long to eat.
We'll hitch a ride, he said, and stop at the first cafe we come to.
Daddy, when I started school, you told me never to ride with strangers.
She was into her underpants and green blouse and was looking at him curiously. Andy got out of bed, walked over to her, and put his hands on her shoulders.
The devil you don't know is sometimes better than the one you do, he said. Do you know what that means, kid?
She thought about it carefully.
The devil they knew was those men from the shop, she guessed.
The men that had chased them down the street in New York the day before. The devil they didn't know.
I guess it means that most people driving cars don't work for that shop, she said.
He smiled back.
You got it. And what I said before still holds, Charlie. When you get into a bad fix, you sometimes have to do things you'd never do if things were going good.
Charlie's smile faded. Her face became serious, watchful.
Like getting the money to come out of the phones?
Yes, he said.
And it wasn't bad?
No, under the circumstances, it wasn't bad.
Because when you get into a bad fix, you do what you have to do to get out of it?
With some exceptions, yes.
What are exceptions, Daddy?
He ruffled her hair.
Never mind now, Charlie. Lighten up.
But she wouldn't.
And I didn't mean to set that man's shoes on fire. I didn't do it on purpose.
No, of course you didn't. Then she did lighten up. Her smile, so much like Vicky's, came out radiantly.
"How does your head feel this morning, Daddy?"
"Much better, thanks."
"Good."
She looked at him closely.
"Your eye looks funny."
"Which eye?" She pointed at his left.
"That one?"
"Yeah?" He went into the bathroom and wiped a clear place on the steamed mirror. He looked at his eye for a long time, his good humor fading. His right eye looked just as it always had, a gray-green, the color of the ocean on an overcast spring day. His left eye was also gray-green, but the white was badly bloodshot, and the pupil looked smaller than the right pupil, and the eyelid had a peculiar droop that he had never noticed before. Vicky's voice suddenly rang into his mind. It was so clear that she might have been standing beside him.
"The headaches, they scare me, Andy. You're doing something to yourself as well as to other people when you use that push, or whatever you want to call it."
The thought was followed by the image of a balloon being blown up, and up, and up, and finally exploding with a loud bang. He began to go over the left side of his face carefully, touching it everywhere with the tips of his right fingers. He looked like a man in a TV commercial marveling over the closeness of his shave. He found three spots, one below his left eye, one on his left cheekbone, and one just below the left temple, where there was no feeling at all. Fright drifted through the hollow places of his body like quiet early evening mist. The fright was not so much for himself as it was for Charlie, for what would happen to her if she got left on her own. As if he had called her, he could see her beyond him in the mirror.
"Daddy?"
She sounded a little scared.
"You okay?"
"Fine," he said. His voice sounded good. There was no tremor in it, nor was it too confident, falsely booming. "Just thinking how much I need a shave." She put a hand over her mouth and giggled.
"Scratchy like a Brillo pad. Yuck! Gross!"
He chased her into the bedroom and rubbed his scratchy cheek against her smooth one. Charlie giggled and kicked. Three. As Andy was tickling his daughter with his stubbly beard, Orville Jameson, a.k.a. O.J., a.k.a. The Juice, and another shop agent named Bruce Cook were getting out of a light blue Chevy outside the Hastings Diner. O.J. paused for a moment, looking down Main Street with its slant parking, its appliance store, its grocery store, its two gas stations, its one drug store, its wooden municipal building with a plaque out front commemorating some historical event no one gave a shit about. Main Street was also Route 40, and the McGees were not 4 miles from where O.J. and Bruce Cook now stood.
"Look at this burg," O.J. said, disgusted. "I grew up close to here. A town called Lowville. You ever heard of Lowville, New York?"
Bruce Cook shook his head.
"It's near Utica, too, where they make Utica Club beer. I was never so happy in my life as I was the day I got out of Lowville."
O.J. reached under his jacket and readjusted the windsucker in its holster.
"There's Tom and Steve," Bruce said.
Across the street, a light brown Pacer had pulled into a parking slot just vacated by a farm truck. Two men in dark suits were getting out of the Pacer. They looked like bankers. Farther down the street at the blinker light, two more shop people were talking to the old cunt that crossed the school kids at lunchtime. They were showing her the picture, and she was shaking her head. There were 10 shop agents here in Hastings Glen, all of them coordinating with Norville Bates, who was back in Albany waiting for Cap's personal ramrod, Al Steinowitz.
"Yeah, Lowville," O.J. sighed. "I hope we get those two suckers by noon, and I hope my next assignment's Karachi, or Iceland, any place, as long as it's not upstate New York. This is too close to Lowville, too close for comfort."
"You think we'll have them by noon?" Bruce asked.
O.J. shrugged. "We'll have them by the time the sun goes down. You can count on that."
They went into the diner, sat at the counter, and ordered coffee. A young waitress with a fine figure brought it to them.
"How long you been on, sis?" O.J. asked her. "If you got a sis, I pity her," the waitress said. "If there's any family resemblance, that is."
"Don't be that way, sis," O.J. said, and showed her his ID. She looked at it a long time. Behind her, an aging juvenile delinquent in a motorcycle jacket was pushing buttons on a Seaburg.
"I've been on since 7, she said. "Same as any other morning. Polly, you want to talk to Mike? He's the owner."
She started to turn away, and O.J. caught her wrist in a tight grip. He didn't like women who made fun of his looks. Most women were sluts anyway. His mother had been right about that, even if she hadn't been right about much else. And his mother surely would have known what to think about a high-tit bitch like this one. "Did I say I wanted to talk to the owner, sis?" She was starting to be frightened now, and that was okay with O.J. "No."
"That's right, because I want to talk to you, not to some guy that's been out in the kitchen scrambling eggs and making Alpo burgers all morning."
He took the picture of Andy and Charlie out of his pocket and handed it to her, not letting go of her wrist.
"You recognize them, sis? Serve them their breakfast this morning, maybe?"
"Let go, you're hurting me."
All the color had gone out of her face except for the whore's rouge she had tricked herself up with. Probably she had been a cheerleader in high school, the kind of girl who laughed at Orville Jameson when he asked them out because he had been president of the chess club instead of quarterback on the football team. Bunch of cheap Lowville whores. God, he hated New York. Even New York City was too fucking close.
"You tell me if you waited on them or if you didn't. Then I'll let go, sis."
She looked briefly at the picture.
"No, I didn't. Now let—"
"You didn't look long enough, sis. You better look again."
She looked again.
"No, no," she said loudly. "I've never seen them. Let me go, can't you?"
The elderly J.D. in the cut-rate Mammoth Mart leather jacket sauntered over, zippers jingling, thumbs hooked in his pants pockets.
"You bothering the lady?" he said.
Bruce Cook gazed at him with open, wide-eyed contempt.
"Be careful we don't decide to bother you next, pizza face," he said.
"Oh," the old kid in the leather jacket said, and his voice was suddenly very small. He moved away quickly, apparently remembering that he had pressing business on the street. Two old ladies in a booth were nervously watching the little scene at the counter. A big man in reasonably clean cook's whites, Mike, the owner, presumably, was standing in the kitchen doorway also watching. He held a butcher knife in one hand, but he held it with no great authority.
"What do you guys want?" he asked.
"They're feds," the waitress said nervously. "They—"
"Didn't serve them? You sure?" O.J. asked. "Sis?"
"I'm sure," she said. She was nearly crying now.
"You better be. A mistake can get you 5 years in jail, sis."
"I'm sure," she whispered. A tear spilled over the bottom curve of one eye and slipped down her cheek. "Please let go. Don't hurt me anymore." O.J. squeezed tighter for a brief moment, liking the feel of the small bones moving under his hand, liking the knowledge that he could squeeze harder yet and snap them. And then he let go. The diner was silent, except for the voice of Stevie Wonder coming from the Seaburg, assuring the frightened patrons of the Hastings Diner that they could feel it all over. Then the two old ladies got up and left in a hurry. O.J. picked up his coffee cup, leaned over the counter, poured the coffee on the floor, and then dropped the cup, which shattered. Thick china shrapnel sprayed in a dozen different directions. The waitress was crying openly now.
"Shitty brew," O.J. said.
The owner made a half-hearted gesture with the knife, and O.J.'s face seemed to light up. "Come on, man," he said, half-laughing. "Come on, let's see you try." Mike put the knife down beside the toaster and suddenly cried out in shame and outrage,
"I fought in Vietnam. My brother fought in Vietnam. I'm going to write my congressman about this. You wait and see if I don't."
O.J. looked at him. After a while, Mike lowered his eyes, scared. The two of them went out. The waitress scooched and began to pick up broken pieces of coffee cups, sobbing. Outside, Bruce said, "How many motels?"
3 motels, 6 sets of tourist cabins," O.J. said, looking down toward the blinker.
It fascinated him. In the Lowville of his youth, there had been a diner with a plaque over the double Silex hot plate, and that plaque had read, "If you don't like our town, look for a timetable." How many times had he longed to pull that plaque off the wall and stuff it down someone's throat? "There are people checking them out," he said, as they walked back toward their light blue Chevrolet, part of a government motor pool paid for and maintained by tax dollars. "We'll know soon now."
Four. John Mayo was with an agent named Ray Knowles. They were on their way out along Route 40 to the Slumberland Motel. They were driving a late model tan Ford, and as they rode up the last hill separating them from an actual view of the motel, a tire blew.
"Shit fire," John said as the car began to pogo up and down and drag to the right.
"That's fucking government issue for you, fucking retreads."
He pulled over onto the soft shoulder and put on the Ford's four-way flashers. "You go on," he said. "I'll change the goddamn tire."
"I'll help," Ray said. "It won't take us 5 minutes."
"Now go on. It's right over this hill. Should be."
"You sure?"
"Yeah, I'll pick you up. Unless the spare's flat, too. Wouldn't surprise me."
A rattling farm truck passed them. It was the one O.J. and Bruce Cook had seen leaving town as they stood outside the Hastings Diner.
Ray grinned. "It better not be. You'd have to put in a requisition in quadruplicate for a new one."
John didn't grin back.
"Don't I know it," he said glumly.
They went around to the trunk and Ray unlocked it. The spare was in good shape.
"Okay," John said. "Go on. It really wouldn't take but 5 minutes to change that sucker."
"Sure. And those two aren't at that motel. But let's play it as if it were real. After all, they have to be somewhere."
"Yeah, okay."
John took the jack and spare out of the trunk. Ray Knowles watched him for a moment and then started walking along the shoulder toward the Slumberland Motel. 5. Just beyond the motel, Andy and Charlie McGee were standing on the soft shoulder of Highway 40. Andy's worries that someone might notice he didn't have a car had proved groundless. The woman in the office was interested in nothing but the small Hitachi TV on the counter. A miniature Phil Donahue had been captured inside, and the woman was watching him avidly. She swept the key Andy offered into a mail slot without even looking away from the picture.
"Hope you enjoyed your stay," she said.
She was working on a box of chocolate coconut donuts and had got to the halfway mark.
"Sure did," Andy said, and left.
Charlie was waiting for him outside. The woman had given him a carbon copy of his bill, which he stuffed into the side pocket of his cord jacket as he went down the steps. Change from the Albany payphones jingled mutedly.
"Okay, Daddy?" Charlie asked as they moved away toward the road.
"Looking good," he said, and put an arm around her shoulders.
To their right and back over the hill, Ray Knowles and John Mayo had just had their flat tire.
"Where are we going, Daddy?" Charlie asked.
"I don't know," he said. "I don't like it. I feel nervous."
"I think we're well ahead of them," he said.
"Don't worry. They're probably still looking for the cab driver who took us to Albany."
But he was whistling past the graveyard. He knew it, and probably Charlie did, too. Just standing here beside the road made him feel exposed, like a cartoon jailbird in a striped suit.
"Quit it," he told himself. "Next thing you'll be thinking they're everywhere, one behind every tree, and a bunch of them right over the next hill." Hadn't somebody said that perfect paranoia and perfect awareness were the same thing?
"Charlie," he began.
"Let's go to Grantham's," she said.
He looked at her, startled. His dream rushed back at him, the dream of fishing in the rain that had turned into the sound of Charlie's shower.
"What made you think of that?" he asked.
Grantham had died long before Charlie was born. He had lived his whole life in Tashmore, Vermont, a town just west of the New Hampshire border. When Grantham died, the place on the lake went to Andy's mother, and when she died, it came to Andy. The town would have taken it for back taxes long since, except that Grantham had left a small sum in trust to cover them. Andy and Vicky had gone up there once a year during the summer vacation until Charlie was born. It was 20 miles off the nearest two-lane road in wooded, unpopulated country. In the summer, there were all sorts of people on Tashmore Pond, which was really a lake with the small town of Bradford, New Hampshire, on the far side. But by this time of year, all the summer camps would be empty. Andy doubted if the road in was even plowed in the winter.
"I don't know," Charlie said. "It just came into my mind this minute."
On the other side of the hill, John Mayo was opening the trunk of the Ford and making his inspection of the spare tire.
"I dreamed about Grantham this morning," Andy said slowly. "First time I'd thought about him in a year or more, I guess, so I suppose you could say he just came into my head, too."
"Was it a good dream, Daddy?"
"Yes," he said, and smiled a little. "Yes, it was."
"Well, what do you think?"
"I think it's a great idea," Andy said. "We can go there and stay for a while and think about what we should do, how we should handle this. I was thinking if we could get to a newspaper and tell our story so that a lot of people knew about it, they'd have to lay off."
An old farm truck was rattling toward them, and Andy stuck out his thumb. On the other side of the hill, Ray Knowles was walking up the soft shoulder of the road. The farm truck pulled over, and a guy wearing bibballs and a New York Mets baseball cap looked out.
"Well, there's a pretty little miss," he said, smiling. "What's your name, missy?"
Roberta, Charlie said promptly. Roberta was her middle name.
Well, Bobby, where are you headed this morning? The driver asked.
We're on our way to Vermont, Andy said. St. Johnsbury. My wife was visiting her sister and she ran into a little problem.
Did you now?
The farmer said, and said no more, but gazed at Andy shrewdly from the corners of his eyes.
Labor, Andy said, and manufactured a wide smile. This one's got a new brother, 141 this morning.
His name is Andy, Charlie said. Isn't that a nice name?
I think it's a corker, the farmer said. You hop on in here and I'll get you 10 miles closer to St. Johnsbury anyhow.
They got in and the farm truck rattled and rumbled back onto the road, headed into the bright morning sunlight. At the same time, Ray Knowles was breasting the hill. He saw an empty highway leading down to the Slumberland Motel. Beyond the motel, he saw the farm truck that had passed their car a few minutes ago just disappearing from view. He saw no need to hurry.
Six. The farmer's name was Manders, Irv Manders. He had just taken a load of pumpkins into town, where he had a deal with the fellow who ran the A&P. He told them that he used to deal with the First National, but the fellow over there just had no understanding about pumpkins. A jumped-up meat cutter and no more, was the opinion of Irv Manders. The A&P manager, on the other hand, was a corker. He told them that his wife ran a touristy sort of shop in the summertime, and he kept a roadside produce stand, and between the two of them, they got along a right smart.
"You won't like me minding your beeswax," Irv Manders told Andy. "But you and your button here shouldn't be thumbing. Lord, no, not with the sort of people you find ramming the roads these days. There's a Greyhound terminal in the drugstore back in Hastings Glen. That's what you want."
"Well," Andy said. He was nonplussed, but Charlie stepped neatly into the breach.
"Daddy's out of work," she said brightly. "That's why my mommy had to go and stay with Auntie Em to have the baby. Auntie Em doesn't like Daddy, so we stayed at home, but now we're going to see Mommy, right, Daddy?"
"That's sort of private stuff, Bobby," Andy said, sounding uncomfortable. He felt uncomfortable. There were 1,000 holes in Charlie's story.
"Don't you say another word," Irv said. "I know about trouble in families. It can get pretty bitter at times, and I know about being hard up. It ain't no shame."
Andy cleared his throat, but said nothing. He could think of nothing to say. They rode in silence for a while.
"Say, why don't you two come home and take lunch with me and the wife?" Irv asked suddenly.
"Oh, no, we couldn't do..."
"We'd be happy to," Charlie said. "Wouldn't we, Daddy?"
He knew that Charlie's intuitions were usually good ones, and he was too mentally and physically worn down to go against her now. She was a self-possessed and aggressive little girl, and more than once Andy had wondered to himself just who was running this show. "If you're sure there's enough," he said.
"Always enough," Irv Manders said,
finally shifting the farm truck into third gear. They were rattling between autumn-bright trees, maples, elms, poplars.
"Glad to have you."
"Thank you very much," Charlie said.
"My pleasure, Button," Irv said. "Be my wife's, too, when she gets a look at you."
Charlie smiled. Andy rubbed his temples. Beneath the fingers of his left hand was one of those patches of skin where the nerves seemed to have died. He didn't feel good about this somehow. That feeling that they were closing in was still very much with him.
7. The woman who had checked Andy out of the Slumberland Motel not 20 minutes ago was getting nervous. She had forgotten all about Phil Donahue.
"You're sure this was the man?" Ray Knowles was saying for the third time.
She didn't like this small, trim, somehow tight man. Maybe he worked for the government, but that was no comfort to Lena Cunningham. She didn't like his narrow face. She didn't like the lines around his cool blue eyes. And most of all, she didn't like the way he kept shoving that picture under her nose.
"Yes, that was him," she said again. "But there was no little girl with him. Honest, mister, my husband'll tell you the same. He works nights. It's got so we hardly ever see each other except at supper. He'll tell..."
The other man came back in, and with ever-mounting alarm, Lena saw that he had a walkie-talkie in one hand and a great big pistol in the other.
"It was them," John Mayo said.
He was almost hysterical with anger and disappointment.
"Two people slept in that bed. Blonde hairs on one pillow, black on the other. God damn that flat tire. God damn it all to hell. Damp towels hanging on the rod in the bathroom. Fucking shower still dripping. We missed them by maybe 5 minutes, Ray."
He jammed the pistol back into its shoulder holster.
"I'll get my husband," Lena said faintly.
"Never mind," Ray said.
He took John's arm and led him outside. John was still swearing about the flat.
Forget the tire, John. Did you talk to O.J. back in town?
I talked to him, and he talked to Norville. Norville's on his way from Albany, and he's got Al Steinowitz with him. He landed not 10 minutes ago.
Well, that's good. Listen. Think a minute, Johnny. They must have been hitching.
Yeah, I guess so, unless they boosted a car.
The guy's an English instructor. He wouldn't know how to boost a candy bar out of a concession stand in a home for the blind.
They were hitching, all right. They hitched from Albany last night. They hitched this morning.
I'd bet you this year's salary that they were standing there by the side of the road with their thumbs out while I was walking up that hill.
If it hadn't been for that flat... John's eyes were miserable behind his wire-framed glasses. He saw a promotion flapping away on slow, lazy wings.
Fuck the flat, Ray said. What passed us? After we got the flat, what passed us?
John thought about it as he hooked the walkie-talkie back on his belt.
Farm truck? He said.
That's what I remember, too, Ray said. He glanced around and saw Lena Cunningham's large moon face peering out the motel office window at them. She saw him seeing her, and the curtain fell back into place.
Pretty rickety truck, Ray said. If they don't turn off the main road, we ought to be able to catch up to them.
Let's go, then, John said. We can keep in touch with Al and Norville by way of O.J. on the walkie-talkie. They trotted back to the car and got in. A moment later, the tan Ford roared out of the parking lot, spewing white crushed gravel out from beneath its rear tires. Lena Cunningham watched them go with relief. Running a motel was not what it once had been. She went back to wake up her husband.
Eight. As the Ford with Ray Knowles behind the wheel and John Mayo riding shotgun was roaring down Route 40 at better than 70 miles an hour, and as a caravan of 10 or 11 similar nondescript late-model cars were heading toward Hastings Glen from the surrounding areas of search, Irv Manders hand-signaled left and turned off the highway onto an unmarked stretch of tar and patch that headed roughly northeast. The truck rattled and banged along. At his urging, Charlie had sung most of her 9-song repertoire, including such golden hits as Happy Birthday to You, This Old Man, Jesus Loves Me, and Camptown Races. Irv and Andy both sang along with that one. The road twisted and wound its way over a series of increasingly wooded ridges and then began to descend toward flatter country that had been cultivated and harvested. Once a partridge burst from a cover of goldenrod and old hay at the left side of the road, and Irv shouted, "Get him, Bobby!" And Charlie pointed her finger and chanted, "Bum-bum-damn!" and then giggled wildly. A few minutes later, Irv turned off on a dirt road, and a mile farther along they came to a battered red, white, and blue mailbox with Manders stenciled on the side. Irv turned into a rutted driveway that was nearly half a mile long.
"Must cost you an arm and a leg to keep it plowed in the winter," Andy said.
"Do it myself," Irv said.
They came to a big white frame farmhouse, 3 stories tall and set off with mint green trim. To Andy, it looked like the sort of house that might have started off fairly ordinary and then grown eccentric as the years passed. 2 sheds were attached to the rear, one of them zigging this away, the other zagging that away. On the south side, a greenhouse wing had been added, and a big screened-in porch stood out from the north side like a stiff shirt. Behind the house was a red barn that had seen better days, and between the house and the barn was what New Englanders call a dooryard, a flat dirt stretch of ground where a couple of dozen chickens clucked and strutted. When the truck rattled toward them, they fled, squawking and fluttering their useless wings, past a chopping block with an axe buried in it. Irv drove the truck into the barn, which had a sweet hay smell Andy remembered from his summers in Vermont. When Irv switched the truck off, they all heard a low, musical mooing from somewhere deeper in the barn's shadowy interior.
"You got a cow?" Charlie said, and something like rapture came over her face. "I can hear it."
"We've got 3, Irv said. "That's Bossy, you hear. A very original name, wouldn't you say, Button? She thinks she's got to be milked 3 times a day. You could see her later if your daddy says you can."
"Can I, Daddy?"
"I guess so," Andy said, mentally surrendering. Somehow they had gone out beside the road to thumb a ride and had got shanghaied instead.
"Come on in and meet the wife."
They strolled across the dooryard, pausing for Charlie to examine as many of the chickens as she could get close to. The back door opened, and a woman of about 45 came out onto the back steps. She shaded her eyes and called,
"You there, Irv! Who you brought home?"
Irv smiled.
"Well, the Button here is Roberta. This fellow is her daddy. I didn't catch his name yet, so I don't know if we're related."
Andy stepped forward and said,
I'm Frank Burton, ma'am. Your husband invited Bobby and me home for lunch, if that's all right. We're pleased to know you.
Me too, Charlie said, still more interested in the chickens than in the woman, at least for the moment.
I'm Norma Manders, she said. Come in. You're welcome.
But Andy saw the puzzled look she threw at her husband.
They all went inside through an entryway where stove lengths were stacked head high into a huge kitchen that was dominated by a wood stove and a long table covered with red and white checked oilcloth. There was an elusive smell of fruit and paraffin in the air. The smell of canning, Andy thought.
Frank here and his button are on their way to Vermont, Irv said. I thought it wouldn't hurt them to get outside of a little hot food on their way.
Of course not, she agreed. Where's your car, Mr. Burton?
Well, Andy began. He glanced at Charlie, but she was going to be no help. She was walking around the kitchen in small steps, looking at everything with a child's frank curiosity.
Frank's had a little trouble, Irv said, looking directly at his wife, but we don't have to talk about that, at least not right now.
All right, Norma said.
She had a sweet and direct face, a handsome woman who was used to working hard. Her hands were red and chapped.
I've got chicken, and I could put together a nice salad, and there's lots of milk. Do you like milk, Roberta?
Charlie didn't look around. She's lapsed on the name, Andy thought. Oh, Jesus, this just gets better and better.
Bobby, he said loudly.
She looked around then and smiled a little too widely.
Oh, sure, she said. I love milk.
Andy saw a warning glance pass from Irv to his wife. No questions, not now. He felt a sinking despair. Whatever had been left of their story had just gone swirling away, but there was nothing to do except sit down to lunch and wait to see what Irv Manders had on his mind.
Nine.
How far from the motel are we? John Mayo asked. Ray glanced down at the odometer.
17 miles, he said, and pulled over.
That's far enough.
But maybe...
No, if we were going to catch them, we would have by now. We'll go on back and rendezvous with the others.
John struck the heel of his hand against the dashboard.
They turned off somewhere, he said. That goddamn flat shoe.
This job's been bad luck from the start, Ray. An egghead and a little girl, and we keep missing them.
No, I think we've got them, Ray said, and took out his walkie-talkie.
He pulled the antenna and tipped it out the window. We'll have a cordon around the whole area in half an hour, and I bet we don't hit a dozen houses before someone around here recognizes that truck. Late '60s, dark green International Harvester, snowplow attachment on the front, wooden stakes around the truck bed to hold on a high load. I still think we'll have them by dark.
A moment later, he was talking to Al Steinowitz, who was nearing the Slumberland Motel. Al briefed his agents in turn. Bruce Cook remembered the farm truck from town.
O.J. did, too. It had been parked in front of the A&P.
Al sent them back to town. And half an hour later, they all knew that the truck that had almost certainly stopped to give the two fugitives a lift belonged to Irving Manders, RFD No. 5, Bailings Road, Hastings Glen, New York. It was just past 12:30 p.m.
10.
The lunch was very nice. Charlie ate like a horse. 3 helpings of chicken with gravy, 2 of Norma Manders' hot biscuits, a side dish of salad, and 3 of her home-canned dill pickles. They finished off with slices of apple pie garnished with wedges of cheddar, Irv offering his opinion that apple pie without a piece of cheese is like a smooch without a squeeze. This earned him an affectionate elbow in the side from his wife. Irv rolled his eyes and Charlie laughed. Andy's appetite surprised him. Charlie belched and then covered her mouth guiltily.
Irv smiled at her.
More room out than there is in, Button.
If I eat any more, I think I'll split, Charlie answered. That's what my mother always used to... I mean, that's what she always says.
Andy smiled tiredly.
Norma, Irv said, getting up, why don't you and Bobby go on out and feed those chickens?
Well, lunch is still spread over half an acre, Norma said.
I'll pick up lunch, Irv said. Want to have a little talk with Frank here.
Would you like to feed the chickens, honey? Norma asked Charlie.
I sure would.
Her eyes were sparkling.
Well, come on then. Do you have a jacket?
It's turned a bit chilly.
Charlie looked at Andy.
You can borrow a sweater of mine, Norma said.
That look passed between her and Irv again.
Roll the sleeves up a little bit and it will be fine.
Okay.
Norma got an old and faded warm-up jacket from the entryway and a frayed white sweater that Charlie floated in, even with the cuffs turned up 3 or 4 times.
"Do they peck?" Charlie asked, a little nervously.
"Only their food, honey."
They went out, and the door closed behind them. Charlie was still chattering. Andy looked at Irv Manders, and Irv looked back calmly.
"You want a beer, Frank?"
"It isn't Frank," Andy said. "I guess you know that."
"I guess I do. What is your handle?"
Andy said, "The less you know, the better off you are."
"Well, then," Irv said, "I'll just call you Frank."
Faintly, they heard Charlie squeal with delight from outside. Norma said something, and Charlie agreed.
"I guess I could use a beer," Andy said.
"Okay." Irv got 2 Utica clubs from the refrigerator, opened them, set Andy's on the table and his on the counter. He got an apron from a hook by the sink and put it on. The apron was red and yellow, and the hem was flounced, but somehow he managed to avoid looking silly.
"Can I help you?" Andy asked.
"No, I know where everything goes," Irv said. "Most everything, anyhow. She changes things from week to week. No woman wants a man to feel right at home in her kitchen. They like help, sure, but they feel better if you have to ask them where to put the casserole dish or where they put the Brillo."
Andy, remembering his own days as Vicky's kitchen apprentice, smiled and nodded.
"Meddling around in other folks' business isn't my strong point," Irv said, drawing water in the kitchen sink and adding detergent. "I'm a farmer, and like I told you, my wife runs a little curio shop down where Bailings Road crosses the Albany Highway. We've been here almost 20 years.
He glanced back at Andy.
"But I knew there was something wrong from the minute I saw you two standing by the road back there. A grown man and a little girl just aren't the kind of pair you usually see hitching the roads. Know what I mean?"
Andy nodded and sipped his beer.
"Furthermore, it looked to me like you'd just come out of the slumberland, but you had no traveling gear, not so much as an overnight case. So I just about decided to pass you by. Then I stopped because, well, there's a difference between not meddling in other folks' business and seeing something that looks damn bad and turning a blind eye to it."
"Is that how we look to you, damn bad?"
"Then," Irv said, "not now."
He was washing the old mismatched dishes carefully, stacking them in the drainer.
"Now, I don't know just what to make of you two. My first thought was it must be you two the cops are looking for."
He saw the change come over Andy's face and the sudden way Andy set his beer can down.
"I guess it is you," he said softly. "I was hoping it wasn't."
"What cops?" Andy asked harshly.
"They've got all the main roads blocked off coming in and out of Albany," Irv said. "If we'd gone another 6 miles up Route 40, we would have run on one of those blocks right where 40 crosses Route 9.
"Well, why didn't you just go ahead?" Andy asked.
"That would have been the end of it for you. You would have been out of it."
Irv was starting on the pots now, pausing to hunt through the cupboards over the sink.
"See what I was saying? I can't find the Glorioski Brillo. What? Here it is. Why didn't I just take you up the road to the cops? Let's say I wanted to satisfy my own natural curiosity."
"You have some questions, huh?"
"All kinds of them," Irv said. "A grown man and a little girl hitching rides. The little girl hasn't got an overnight case, and the cops are after them. So I have an idea. It isn't so far-fetched. I think that maybe here's a daddy who wanted custody of his button and couldn't get it. So he snatched her."
"That sounds pretty far-fetched to me."
"Happens all the time, Frank. And I think to myself, the mommy didn't like that so well and swore out a warrant on the daddy. That would explain all the roadblocks.
You only get coverage like that for a big robbery or a kidnapping."
"She's my daughter, but her mother didn't put the police on us," Andy said. "Her mother has been dead for a year."
"Well, I'd already kind of shit-canned the idea," Irv said. "It don't take a private eye to see the two of you are pretty close. Whatever else may be going on, it doesn't appear you've got her against her will."
Andy said nothing. "So here we are at my problem," Irv said. "I picked the two of you up because I thought the little girl might need help. Now I don't know where I'm at. You don't strike me as the desperado type. But all the same, you and your little girl are going under false names. You're telling a story that's just as thin as a piece of tissue paper. And you look sick, Frank. You look just about as sick as a man can get and still stay on his feet. So those are my questions. Any you could answer, it might be a good thing."
"We came to Albany from New York and hitched a ride to Hastings Glen early this morning," Andy said. "It's bad to know they're here, but I think I knew it. I think Charlie knew it, too." He'd mentioned Charlie's name, and that was a mistake, but at this point it didn't seem to matter. "What do they want you for, Frank?" Andy thought for a long time, and then he met Irv's frank gray eyes. He said, "You came from town, didn't you? See any strange people there? City types? Wearing these neat off-the-rack suits that you forget almost as soon as the guys wearing them are out of sight? Driving late-model cars that sort of just fade into the scenery?" It was Irv's turn to think. "There were two guys like that in the A&P," he said. "Talking to Helga. She's one of the checkers. Looked like they were showing her something." "Probably our picture," Andy said. "They're government agents. They're working with the police, Irv. A more accurate way of putting it would be that the police are working for them. The cops don't know we're wanted." "What sort of government agency are we talking about? FBI?" "No. The shop." "What? That CIA outfit?" Irv looked frankly disbelieving. "They don't have anything at all to do with the CIA," Andy said. "The shop is really the DSI, Department of Scientific Intelligence. I read in an article about 3 years ago that some wiseacre nicknamed it the shop in the early 60s, after a science fiction story called The Weapon Shops of Ishtar, by a guy named Van Vogt, I think, but that doesn't matter. What they're supposed to be involved in are domestic scientific projects, which may have present or future application to matters bearing on national security. That definition is from their charter, and the thing they're most associated with in the public mind is the energy research they're funding and supervising, electromagnetic stuff and fusion power. They're actually involved in a lot more. Charlie and I are part of an experiment that happened a long time ago. It happened before Charlie was even born. Her mother was also involved. She was murdered. The shop was responsible." Irv was silent for a while. He let the dishwater out of the sink, dried his hands, and then came over and began to wipe the oilcloth that covered the table. Andy picked up his beer can. "I won't say flat out that I don't believe you," Irv said finally. "Not with some of the things that have gone on undercover in this country and then come out. CIA guys giving people drinks spiked with LSD and some FBI agent accused of killing people during the civil rights marches and money in brown bags and all that. So I can't say right out that I don't believe you. Let's just say you haven't convinced me yet." "I don't think it's even me that they really want anymore," Andy said. "Maybe it was once, but they've shifted targets. It's Charlie they're after now." "You mean the national government is after a first or second grader for reasons of national security?" "Charlie's no ordinary second grader," Andy said. "Her mother and I were injected with a drug which was coded Lot 6. To this day, I don't know exactly what it was. Some sort of synthetic glandular secretion would be my best guess. It changed the chromosomes of myself and of the lady I later married. We passed those chromosomes on to Charlie, and they mixed in some entirely new way. If she could pass them on to her children, I guess she'd be called a mutant. If for some reason she can't, or if the change has caused her to be sterile, I guess she'd be called a sport or a mule. Either way, they want her. They want to study her, see if they could figure out what makes her able to do what she can do. And even more, I think they want her as an exhibit. They want to use her to reactivate the Lot 6 program." "What is it she can do?" Irv asked. Through the kitchen window, they could see Norma and Charlie coming out of the barn. The white sweater flopped and swung around Charlie's body, the hem coming down to her calves. There was high color in her cheeks, and she was talking to Norma, who was smiling and nodding. Andy said softly, "She can light fires." "Well, so can I," Irv said. He sat down again and was looking at Andy in a peculiar, cautious way, the way you look at people you suspect of madness. "She can do it simply by thinking about it," Andy said. "The technical name for it is pyrokinesis. It's a psi talent, like telepathy, telekinesis, or precognition. Charlie has a dash of some of those as well, by the way, but pyrokinesis is much rarer and much more dangerous. She's very much afraid of it, and she's right to be. She can't always control it. She could burn up your house, your barn, or your front yard if she set her mind to it. Or she could light your pipe." Andy smiled wanly. "Except that while she was lighting your pipe, she might also burn up your house, your barn, and your front yard."
Irv finished his beer and said, I think you ought to call the police and turn yourself in, Frank. You need help.